American-led airstrikes continued this weekend, targeting the militant group ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria.
The organization's rapid rise threw Iraq into disarray and changed the shape of the civil war in Syria as well. While the organization seemed to come out of nowhere and caught the U.S. by surprise, our next guest breaks down the story of ISIS in a new Frontline documentary.
Martin Smith is with us now. He's a producer and filmmaker for Frontline. His new documentary is The Rise of ISIS. It airs tonight at 9 on public television stations here in Wisconsin. Martin, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back. Thank you.
Well, you start the story with the withdrawal of the last U.S. ground troops from Iraq in late 2011. Here's a listen to President Obama pulled from your documentary.
What we have now achieved is an Iraq that is self-governing, that is inclusive, and that has enormous potential.
Well, at that time, the seed that grew into ISIS was the remnants of al-Qaeda in Iraq. What did that group look like at that point when the U.S. Completed its withdrawal?
At that point, they were pretty much on their last legs. They had been turned on by not only a surge in U.S. troops in 2007, but tribesmen of the so-called Sunni Awakening had come over to fight against them. And they really were just a few embittered tribesmen, some jihadis, some al-Qaeda remnants, and some Baathists who were looking to regain power. But they were basically a pretty small force, not really much of a threat.
Well, a theme throughout this Frontline documentary is how the Shiite Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, treated Sunnis in Iraq and how that contributed to the problem. After the withdrawal of U.S. troops, what did the Prime Minister do with the Sunni community?
Broadly speaking, he did a couple of things. One is he cracked down on people he suspected of being a threat to him. That meant not only ordinary Sunni men who were suspected of subversion for some reason or another, but also members of his own cabinet. His vice president, as well as his finance minister, were purged. The vice president was tried in absentia and given a death sentence. And this greatly angered a broad swath of Sunnis, who began peaceful demonstrations that went on for a long time. The other thing that he did that's really significant is that he, fearing that there might be a coup d'etat, he took people in the military and fired them if he suspected they weren't loyal enough to him. And he replaced them with people who would be loyal. But in doing so, the army lost a lot of its professionalism. It became an army of cronies more than a professional army, even after the Americans had spent so much treasure to train and equip that army. It was really a sort of rotten at the core by the time ISIS was moving on Fallujah and Mosul this year.
In addition to the purges in the government and in the army, even daily life for Sunnis, especially young men, was difficult. You have a British former intelligence officer saying it was commonplace to see Sunnis with bullets in their heads due to Shia militia.
That's true. And by 2013, you see a real spike in violence from these militia that are taking out revenge on Sunnis that they suspected of being part of an insurgency. But in many cases, people were held in prisons without charges for months on end, and people were, in some cases, documented by the United Nations, executed without trials.
Did this lead Sunnis who might not have been sympathetic to an al-Qaeda holdover group being more willing to accept them as a viable option to the Iraqi government?
Well, it radically polarized the country, of course. But what really took it down that path was when there was a demonstration, a peaceful demonstration, been going on for months in the town of Hawija in north of Baghdad. And we don't know exactly what happened. There may have been a provocateur from the among the demonstrators, but at whatever happened exactly, the forces of Maliki's government, the police and the army, unleashed a fusillade of bullets on the peaceful demonstrators, and you had the massacre of scores of Sunnis. And that led a lot of Sunnis to conclude that they really needed more muscle. And it was around that same time that Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which became the Islamic State of Iraq, had now changed its name to the Islamic State of Iraq in Syria, or Al-Sham, or Levant, depending. And that was when they started to see more people coming into their ranks. And it's not the, and of course they're now starting to get some foreign recruits. So they're growing in different ways, and different people come to join ISIS today with very different motivations. But the core of it, and that's what we explain in the documentary, was widespread Sunni anger, frustration, disenfranchisement it gets to the point where Sunnis just don't think they have any option but to let ISIS be their protector.
We've stayed on the Iraqi side of the border, but you point also in the documentary to the entry of this group that became ISIS into Syria, the idea of the Syrian civil war as a gift to these militants. How so? How did they take off so quickly?
It was essentially the incubator. In all insurgencies, it's very important that they have some kind of sanctuary, a place they can go, whether, you know, it's the Taliban has used Pakistan that way. And through history, the importance of sanctuary is key. It's also true that when they go into, when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of the group, sends a few men over into Syria, he has surrounded himself with some rather experienced military officers who are very smart and able to, not only are they raising money from around the Gulf from deep-pocketed Sunnis for their cause, they're able to become a self-sustaining operation by running extortion rackets, taxing the local population, and even seizing oil fields and selling oil on the black market. And quickly, within 12 months, the group that was Al-Qaeda in Iraq and is going to become ISIS has become a self-sustaining operation with increasing numbers of fighters in its ranks.
We're talking to Martin Smith about his new Frontline documentary, The Rise of ISIS, looking at the history, the goals of the Islamic State movement.
And you can join our conversation. Do you have a question about how the group became so powerful in Syria and Iraq? You can call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation with Martin Smith. His new Frontline documentary is called The Rise of ISIS.
Now, Martin, we had just talked about the progress of what became ISIS early on in Iraq, their cross-border move into Syria. In those earlier stages, was the United States sitting up and taking notice, doing anything in response?
Well, the United States was paying attention. There were certainly discussions about what was happening in Iraq and in Syria. And there were recommendations, as any, if you watch the documentary, you will see that both Ambassador Ford to Syria and Ambassador Jeffrey to Iraq, as well as senior members of the cabinet, were advising the administration that something should be done to arm moderate rebels in Syria, in order to prevent the ISIS rebels from becoming dominant, and also to hold Maliki's feet to the fire and do more on the one hand to leverage what we could to get reforms of his government. At the same time, as things got worse, to give him some more weapons so he could repel ISIS. But those for reasons that I think are defensible, the administration felt, I think, twofold. They felt that what was happening in those countries was not posing an imminent threat to the United States. And this is a president who was elected on the basis of the country's consensus being that it's time to get out of the area. And the other was that they simply didn't trust Maliki. If he would make a promise of one kind or another, their experience, what they expressed to me, was that he didn't follow through. So they didn't have a partner that they could trust. So for those two reasons, you know, they did increase some weapons transfers, but the Iraqis that I spoke to felt that it wasn't enough. And I think the Obama administration really, until recently, didn't feel that they were dealing with a threat that warranted more attention.
So picking up the thread of where ISIS went next, they had gotten this support, as you said, in Iraq because of the Maliki government driving Sunnis into ever more angry opposition to his practices. In Syria, they'd picked up recruits, some weapons, some funding. What tactics did they turn to now in Iraq?
Well, they have launched a program called Breaking the Walls, which was focused on attacking 8 major prisons. And they start this in mid-2012, and it culminates in 2013 with a major breakout of prisoners from Abu Ghraib, the infamous prison. And more than 500 inmates are released, and that swells their ranks. A lot of these guys were already insurgents. And so that is a major focus. They had another program called Soldiers Harvest. That was their term for it, where they would seek out Iraqi soldiers and kill them and destroy their homes as a part of an intimidation program. And then when we get a little later on, in January of this year, they're able to actually seize Fallujah, which is not so many miles outside of Baghdad. And you know, the story from there is known somewhat. I mean, they take Mosul in June of this year.
I want to get back to Mosul in a moment, but let's go to the phones with Mikhail in Eau Claire. Mikhail, hi.
Yes, hello. I just had a question about how they have become so well-armed and who's supplying them their weapons, and how have they acquired so many to where they're such a formidable force?
Mikhail, thanks. Martin?
Sure, it's a good question, and I'll divide it into two parts. The first part is that before they take Mosul, they are able to get weapons because they are getting support and money through their own operations, as I've mentioned, their extortion rackets or their oil sales. And they can buy weapons on the black market, or they learn about weapon shipments that are going to the more moderate rebels, and they then hit those rebels and steal their weapons. That's one way. After Mosul, it's a different ballgame, because when they roll into Mosul and the Iraqi army abandons their post and flees the city, they're able to collect tons upon tons of U.S.-made sophisticated weaponry, tanks, artillery, armored Humvees, and more. And so by the time we get to June of this year, they're a formidable fighting force. Now, they may not be as organized as some, but they're one of the better-armed armies in the region. And when they went against Kurdistan, they were able to overrun the Peshmerga. That's the Kurdish fighting force, because the ISIS fighters had superior American weapons.
And one thing I learned in this documentary I hadn't realized, the takeover of Mosul was a surprise to everyone, including ISIS themselves.
Yeah, now they thought they were just going to do another prison breakout. This was information that came via Dexter Filkins of The New Yorker, who had spoken to an intelligence agent in Kurdistan, who said that the idea that Mosul had was to roll in the city, have a couple of suicide bombs outside the prison, and free more prisoners. But when they got in, the army just collapsed. And so they said, hey, we're just going to keep going. And they were able to take the whole city within a matter of a few days. Only 800 fighters came in initially, and they got the city, just fell in their hands. They were really pushing on an open door.
You mentioned one difference from al-Qaeda to ISIS, this idea of taking territory, holding it, getting this revenue stream. Also, even more bloodlust in some ways than al-Qaeda. That's part of what led al-Qaeda internationally to break with ISIS. Why this focus on executions and killing to a degree we hadn't seen previously?
You know, I can only speculate there, but I think that it's been effective for them in terms of terrorizing people that might go up against them, whether that be the Iraqi security forces, the Peshmerga, or other rebel groups in Syria, or the Syrian army itself. I think I think they use that as a tactic to scare the hell out of people with their viciousness. It is a different animal than Al-Qaeda in that they are not a hit-and-run operation. They are all about seizing territory and holding it and declaring a state. They've, of course, now called themselves the Islamic State, and they claim that they are going to be erasing more borders than simply the Syrian and Iraqi border. They're very ambitious in their rhetoric. It's hard to know how far they can go. The bombs have certainly, are a burden upon them. But right now they seem to be able to hold on to quite a bit of territory.
Martin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much.
We've been talking to Martin Smith. He's the producer of the new Frontline documentary. It's called The Rise of ISIS. You can see that on your local public television station. It's going to air tonight at 9.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll celebrate the 150th anniversary of Yosemite National Park with a look at the photography of Ansel Adams.
First, we're talking about new federal guidelines issued by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Ebola.
The new guidelines separate people into categories based on their level of exposure to people with Ebola. Each category has its own set of preventive measures. Those who are considered high risk, for example, people who have cared for family members with Ebola without protective gear, they're not allowed to use public transportation, board an airplane, or go to work. People who are considered low risk just need to monitor their temperature and their symptoms.
Here to talk about the new guidelines and put them into context is Dr. Jeff Duchin. He's the chair of the Infectious Diseases Society of America's Public Health Committee. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's walk through these new guidelines by the CDC. What are they?
Well, these guidelines are intended to assure that persons who come back from Ebola-affected countries or have exposures to potential Ebola infectious situations are appropriately monitored by public health authorities. You know, we have a couple of systems in place now to decrease the already relatively low risk of Ebola in our country, and these include both exit screening from the affected areas, entry screening at our ports where all persons whose itineraries originate in these affected areas are now deplaning and being screened actively for illness. At those locations, they're providing contact information for their final destination, and that information is being forwarded to state and local public health authorities so that when they arrive, they can be actively monitored for 21 days. And that active monitoring is really the crux of the guidance, because we know that based on our experience with Ebola from past outbreaks and from what's known about how the virus acts in the body, persons who don't have symptoms don't spread the disease. And the infectiousness increases such that early in the illness, it's unlikely to be highly infectious. And as the illness becomes more severe with uncontrolled diarrhea, vomiting, possibly bleeding, the risk of infection is quite high. And at that point, patients are typically in healthcare facilities where our healthcare providers are taking special precautions to prevent exposure.
As I understand it, the CDC can't actually enforce these guidelines. For example, New York and New Jersey seem to be creating some of their own guidelines or protocols. So how will they actually be used around the United States?
Right. So the guidance is for implementation at the state and local level, because the authority to restrict the movement and, if necessary, involuntarily restrict the movement of persons that are not traveling internationally or between states is really a power of the states or local governments. CDC has authority to restrict movement of people coming into the U.S. and moving from state to state. But most activity is occurring within states, and that's where the power lies to enforce any sort of limitations or restrictions on movement. Now, the guidance is pretty clear for people at high risk and low risk. I don't think it's very controversial. It's very direct. I think the instructions to restrict the movements of persons at high risk and not to restrict the movement of people at low risk is quite clear. But there are some subtleties and some options involved in what might be implemented with respect to people who have intermediate levels of risk. So the CDC is calling these some risk or low but not zero risk. And lots of the returning humanitarian workers and physicians and healthcare providers, nurses that are essential to actually controlling this outbreak in West Africa. And I think it's really important here to understand that the number one priority to reduce the risk in the U.S. is to stop this outbreak in West Africa. That is the only way that we're ultimately going to eliminate any Ebola concerns here in the U.S. So we need to do everything possible to allow our healthcare workers to facilitate that. There's a need for tens of thousands of healthcare workers to get that under control, and our folks need to continue to participate. But many of the people who come back and fall into this some risk category are humanitarian workers and are healthcare providers from U.S.-based who are returning. And so the CDC guidance offers several options for managing those folks. Again, the key is active monitoring of symptoms, and that's really what we endorse at the Infectious Disease Society of America. We don't believe that involuntary restrictions of their movement is necessary or appropriate.
Well, let's talk about that a little, because there have been those who have been calling for mandatory quarantines, among them lawmakers, some of them prominent. Why do you think that mandatory quarantines are not the right way to go?
Well, a couple of reasons. I think one is the risk to the public is very low if people are complying with active monitoring. For most of these people who are asymptomatic, the risk is zero. And early in the disease, when symptoms are recognized promptly, the risk is probably very close to zero. So if you've got people who are complying, you want to use the least restrictive measures necessary to get your aims accomplished. The healthcare workers that come back understand Ebola disease. They will know that they're going to need to be monitored for 21 days. They need to be contacted in person at least once a day, and once by telephone or email, so that at the earliest onset of symptoms, they can then be restricted from public activity. They can be evaluated and tested to see if they have an illness that might be Ebola. But involuntarily restricting their activities when they present little to no risk to the public can be counterproductive. Again, we need to really do everything possible to help our healthcare workers participate in the important outbreak control activities that are needed in West Africa. And by putting up barriers like this, which can make it difficult for them to participate by not allowing them to do what they need to do when they come home, perhaps be with their families, go to work, do other things that they feel like they need to do. They've already taken some time off to participate in outbreak control activities if they can't work or participate in whatever it is their obligations are when they get back. That may inhibit people from volunteering to do this important work. In addition, if folks feel like this is an inappropriate and punitive action, it's possible that they will try and conceal their history, and maybe we won't be able to even recognize then people coming in who have legitimate risk factors for Ebola infections, but aren't getting into the system. So currently, these folks are recognized, they come into the system voluntarily, and it's through their cooperation that we're able to monitor their symptoms and protect the public health by taking them and isolating them if they become symptomatic. But if people decide that this is a punitive and inappropriate strategy, such as involuntary quarantine, and they decide to try and evade it, then we lose them altogether, and we don't have the ability to monitor their symptoms or be able to promptly get them out of the public or situations where they would be in contact with others should they develop early symptoms.
Now, recently, a New York doctor who had been treating Ebola patients with Doctors Without Borders was found to have the virus, had been on a subway. There were maps showing all the places that he had been, including a restaurant and, in public places. And that caused some anxiety in New York for a while. But you're saying, even though there may be anxiety associated with the movement of these caregivers who've been in Ebola-stricken places, that it's better to stick with active monitoring. Why do you make the case for that?
Because, and I recognize the anxiety, we really need to work with the public and do everything we can to sort of reassure them about the actual level of risk. The reason I say that we should not restrict the activity is because the risk is extremely low. Remember that Mr. Duncan, the Liberian, who died of Ebola, was in his household symptomatic before he was admitted to the hospital for days, and no one in his household developed Ebola virus. Household members, and these are close contacts of Ebola virus patients who don't have direct contact with their blood or body fluids, who are not caregivers of sick Ebola patients, do not get infected readily. It's not highly infectious. So the risk to the public is very low, particularly early in the disease. I think it's important that we do whatever we can to reassure the public. And I think one thing that might be a reasonable option would be to ask persons who are being monitored to limit non-essential activities so that the concern, the perception, is minimized, perception of risk, even though it's not a true threat to the public health. And also perhaps to keep a log of their activities so that if it's ever necessary, the public can be reassured that we know where these people have been, we can get counseling out, because really that's what's most needed, is just good information to the people about the low level of risk that they actually have. And you see in New York as well, the activities of the physician the night before he became ill, the day before he became ill, created some public consternation and concern. But in the medical and scientific community, the risk assessment is that he presented almost no risk to the public.
And we leave it there. Dr. Jeff Duchin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Good night.
Jeff Duchin is chair of the Infectious Diseases Society of America's Public Health Committee. He was with us to talk about the new federal guidelines for Ebola issued recently by the CDC.
And you can hear more about Ebola tomorrow morning on the Joy Cardine Show. Joy's guest says when it comes to Ebola, we should fear the fear more than we should fear the virus. That's tomorrow morning at 6. 150 years ago this year, in 1864, during the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln signed the Yosemite Grant Act. It was the first land grant in the nation's history dedicated to protecting wilderness for the enjoyment of people, and it paved the way for the U.S. National Park System.
When you picture Yosemite Valley, there is a good chance one person's images in particular come to mind, those of Ansel Adams. Adams was an environmentalist and photographer and spent years capturing the park's landscapes in black and white, images that have become icons of modern art.
Here with us to talk about Ansel Adams and his ties to Yosemite is Peter Galassi. He's a former chief curator of photography at the Museum of Modern Art. To commemorate the park's 150th anniversary, he's put out a collection of Ansel Adams photographs. It's titled Ansel Adams in Yosemite Valley, celebrating the park at 150. It comes out today. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, today we're all photographers with our phones and whatnot, but Ansel Adams, still lives on as a legend. What made his images so iconic?
Well, I think there are probably two answers to that. One, the young Ansel Adams was a great adventurous artist who found a way to embody in his pictures a sort of private mystical experience of nature, which for him had really first blossomed in Yosemite, which stayed the core of his aesthetic. Then the second answer is that much later on in his career, Adams became probably the leading conservationist in the conservation movement, which was a very public and in fact very effective movement for protecting wilderness in the U.S. And those are two very different people.
Now, I've read that he used a large capacity camera to get some of those images because it provided a specific effect. In terms of just the technique that he used, what was remarkable about it?
Well, we really are talking about a technology that is now obsolete. But he made negatives on film, although maybe when he started, some of them were on glass. But he made large negatives. So, for example, 8 by 10 inches. So, which means in order to make the large negative, you have to have a large camera that sits on a tripod, which means that if you're photographing in a place like Yosemite, you've got a lot of trekking to do early on with a burro. And that those large negatives recorded a great deal of information, which he then translated into exquisitely precise prints. He was a technical master.
What was it about Yosemite that led Ansel Adams to fall in love with it, in some ways make it his life's work?
Well, he first went there. He was born in San Francisco in 1902. He first went there when he was 14 years old in 1816, which, remember, that's now almost 100 years ago. And it was a different world. Yosemite was still, there were some hotels, there were some roads and so forth, but it was a magical experience for him that changed his life. I mean, he, for the next 10 years or so, he continued to pursue his talent as a pianist. He could have been a concert pianist, but in the end he chose photography, and a lot of the reason was because of the depth of his feeling for nature in Yosemite.
Can you describe a couple of his most famous photographs for us?
Oh, Lord. I think that's a lot of trouble. But let me tell you, the most familiar view of Yosemite is at the mouth of the valley, looking down the axis of the valley, with the big monuments on either side, where looking down towards Half Dome in the middle. And that's a picture, that's a view that he explored over and over and over again. And as he himself explained, the view is always great. The photographs are only great when it's made alive by light and weather. And this was at the core of Adams' aesthetic, was a sort of flickering vitality that he managed to capture in his very beautiful prints, and that brought the place alive in the prints. And so the pictures of that view, like Clearing Winter Storm, where there's all kinds of it looks like what it sounds like, and he loved to photograph right after a storm and when the clouds and the light were very surprising.
Is there something about his black and white photography of Yosemite that does something that we couldn't do with color even today?
No, I wouldn't say that. The when photography began, it was monochrome, often brown and white. And so there was a very rich tradition of photographs in monochrome that Adams inherited and extended. Later on, he did commercial work as in color and so forth. But a photographer born in 1902 had to learn to see the world in black and white.
What relationship do his photographs have with his eventual becoming of an environmentalist, a conservationist?
Well, when he fell in love with Yosemite, and he fell in love with the experience of being in nature, and he was a great climber and explorer and hiker, and of course the people who almost all of the people who have that depth of feeling for nature want to help protect it, which is of course why this book is coming out. The Adams Trust wanted to do this book because it's the anniversary of Lincoln's Yosemite Grant, and the whole purpose was to protect these places. So the love of the nature and the dedication to the conservation movement, and Ansel was very dedicated to it, do go hand in hand.
And how did his photographs inspire others to help preserve that in other parks? And maybe on to today, this new book, will that inspire people to protect these lands and others now?
I hope so. But that's not the purpose of the book. The purpose of the book is to explore the work of a great photographer in the place that made him a photographer. But there's nothing, I mean, I haven't seen how to put this. it's Ansel's work became very useful politically for protecting the wilderness, and I think that's a great thing. But that isn't why he made the best of his work. He made it because of his personal relationship to nature that he that prompted him to be an artist. And that's a very private thing.
And you said he had sort of mystical experiences in that landscape. What do you mean by that?
Well, I wish I had one wonderful. He was an incessant letter writer and a writer of introductions to books and things like that. And he did once write about his experience where looking at the sun playing on the grass, that it looked like silver and so on. It was, and he's not alone in having these, in having this experience of being in wild nature. And having it move him very deeply.
We'll leave it there. Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Peter Galassi, former chief curator of photography at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. His new collection is Ansel Adams in Yosemite Valley, celebrating the park at 150.